Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Marking both World Mission Sunday and the European Day Against Human Trafficking. And then on a totally different note, bringing you part 13 of our ongoing series, The Vatican Centuries. But first, here in the Vatican, the second special assembly of the Synod of Bishops for Africa, which began on the 4th of October, is almost at the end of its second week, continuing its reflections on the Church's role in promoting reconciliation, justice, and peace. Among the over 200 church leaders plus religious or lay experts making formal presentations and sharing their experiences is Cambonian Father Paulino Mondo, who's attending the synod in his quality as theologian of the Kenyan Bishops' Conference. Father Paulino does many things for the church in Kenya, but he says he's always around trying to track where Jesus has passed. That's in his parish of Kariobangi, or Holy Trinity, a slum in Nairobi.
A slum, I mean an informal settlement. That is the place where there was land. People moved there by themselves and they put up shanties. And now it is a little city without any order. Then we call it a slum because that is the...
No light, no drains?
Yes, there is no drainage. Lights are put, but in an illegal manner. Every now and then we are fighting with the company of Kenya Power and Lighting because they come and dismantle everything. In the night it is put back. Water is carried by containers because there could be sources of water. And the water in slums is 10 times costly than a person who has a meter of fish in his own compound. Now, how did the slums come to be in Nairobi? Nairobi was a market, a trading center, and the East African trade was stopping there. But slowly by slowly, people started the coffee farms in Nairobi. That is 100 years ago. And these owners of coffee farms wanted the people to work for them. But these people were not allowed to stay anywhere near the farmers, who were many of them from Britain. They were from United Kingdom. So people would walk like 10 kilometers, get where to sleep on their own. So slums started mushrooming up. Right now, Nairobi has a population of 4 million people, and 2.7 million live in slums. So you can imagine what type of statistics. Our parish of Holy Trinity Kariobangi alone covers 9 square kilometers, and the statistics of the other census, which was just a month ago, tells us that we are 500,000 people, half a million. In our registers, I know we have baptized 69,000. So when you put that huge number of people in the area in which you are, you can already imagine a mess. But this does not stop us from teaching the Word of God, because I have both the catechetical and developmental pedagogies I use. I tell the Christians, those who are in our parishes, that the slum is not a place you can call home. It is like a bus stage. You come, you wait here. When you get means, you go away. So as they prepare them in the catechesis, and as they go to work, I have put a cooperative. It's called the Huruma Self Help Group. So they have to do savings. If you are a Catholic in my church, you must open a bank account. And when you save enough, like 4 years, you have to move away and buy a plot and then say bye-bye to the slum. Of course, I will also lose you in the parish, but it is a better life, is better organized. More than that, we are also organizing slum upgrading, because half of the parish is on what we call the crown land. The land belongs to the government, not to the people. But these people have been on this land for the last 30 years. So juridically, they own land out of common sense. We can say they have nowhere else to go. So we have started a system of making sure that we build right houses, the way you have seen maybe in South Africa, the Soweto way, so that these people can become owners and the government can give them papers to acknowledge that they own that place. But apart from being a slum and all the troubles we go through, there are also very beautiful things we experience. The slum is full of children. Those men and women can produce. So my baptisms, the record is, if I am below line every year, I have over 400 baptisms of infants. And people bring them joyfully. We have a huge celebration. We baptize only 4 times a year, so as to give it more impact. When you talk about abortion in my parish, nobody will listen to you, because children are a joy. Children fulfill. Children bring back a smile at the faces of the people. Then we have also schools. We have put up our own informal schools in the parish. For us, everybody must go to school. We have Franciscan Missionary Sisters of Africa. They have over 2,000 small children in the kindergarten. We feed them and we educate them, preparing them for our primary schools. We have 3 informal primary schools. The children inside them, they are over 6,000. Those are of the church. We know why we put these children there. Some are unable to go to any government primary school, and others are a bit secret, or they are orphans, so want to give them a bit of warmth of faith. But we have also government primary schools that we built in the parish and handed them over to the Minister of Education. To keep children there, we decided to buy lunch for these children. Our lunch is beans and maize, but for us is very stable. We need that. So we have over 20,000 children kept in school because there is lunch there. So that is a lifeline. We have put up a secondary school of both boys and girls. And last year alone, I sent 90 boys and girls to the university. So for me, this is one way of making sure that the slums become a stepping stone in development. We take care of our health in that place. We have also a women promotion project. If by mistake our girls in the slums get pregnant, we tell them, keep the baby. We are pro-lifers, but we take them to a college to teach them a trade, whether it's catering, knitting, sewing. For us, we don't compare sin with a sinner. A sinner is a friend of God. Sin is the only thing that has to be rejected. So we uplift them. We have other little hobbies we have started, like carpentry, like making hair, because the African woman with her hair, they are as friendly as a man could be friendly, I don't know, with his own family. And then all of the people in our parishes who reach 18 are registered in government. They have a national identity card, meaning they can go to any factory and ask for casual labor. So I would say our parish is a small engine of a family of God.
And my thanks there go to Comboni Father Paulino Mondo, who runs the parish of Kariobangi, or Holy Trinity, in Nairobi. Meanwhile, the 18th of October marks Mission Sunday. To mark this special day, Emma McCarthy spoke to Divine Word missionary Father Timothy Lahan, the new Secretary General of the Pontifical Society for the Propagation of the Faith.
The mission territory isn't as far-flung afield as Latin America or Sub-Saharan Africa or the Pacific coast, but perhaps the mission territory we need to look at is actually in our own local communities, in the big cities that we all live in so-called developed countries.
There's a French singer that sings a song. He says, "We have gone around the moon and we failed to do the journey around man's heart." Pope Benedict himself says, he said about 2 or 3 years ago, that what we need today is to touch man's heart, to touch the human heart. That's the mission today. The person in the Northern Hemisphere that's living in a material world which is full of material goods, now we come to a stage where many are without work, where many have discovered that the material quest that they tried to overcome, if you could say, over the last number of years, hasn't worked, because material goods, all of a sudden we're told that there's no money there. All of a sudden we're told that my house is not my house anymore, it's the house of the bank, and then the bank has no money and I have no money. And all of a sudden we discover that money, what is it? So we have to go beyond that. And I think Mother Teresa put it beautifully. She was talking to a group of North American businessmen, very, very rich men, Catholic men. And 'twas one of them told me himself after a couple of years after the meeting, he said, when she was talking to us, we were very, very wealthy businessmen. And one of our members said at the time, "How can we help you, Mother Teresa? You know, we can we can help you with something after your wonderful talk. And she just responded to the man. She said, love your wife. And he felt that she didn't understand him, so he came back again. He asked the same question. He said, but mother, he said, we here amongst us can build hospitals for you. We can help you with the wonderful work that you're doing, and we want to help your mother. And she responded again, love your wife. So he asked her a third time, and she responded again. Then he said, why? Because she said, once there's love, once you love, then the other will come. The other will come. So I think that's very important. Once I discover love, God is love. So once I discover God, who is love in my life, and God who has loved me into being, and God who has loved me into transforming me as a son of Adam, when God transforms me, and when I discover that transformation of God in my life, that's the good news. That's the good news for me. So I go out and I help others to understand that good news. And then we become a family, and that's what we're called, the people of God. The church is called the people of God. And that's why we're called the people of God. And then as a people of God, we act as a people of God amongst ourselves. And then we go forth as a people of God into the economic world of today, into the economic crisis of today in Northern Europe. And as a people of God, we react to the problems that the economic situation is causing in the boardroom of the bank, in the boardroom of the company, and that reaction will help us amongst ourselves, but that reaction will also take us to the wider world. Because if you look at the whole ecosystem today, we're talking about that all this global warming. So in a sense of what's happening in Africa is going to affect me. You know, if you turn down the volume of your news program at night and just see, how do we react when we see the bodies of 150 African migrants being brought ashore in southern France or southern Italy? They have left Africa in a hope of a better world, and then their bodies are washed up in our seashores. How do I react to that? The mission of the church goes beyond frontiers, it goes beyond borders. So if I'm a people of God, if I'm a member of the people of God, that man who's washed up on the shore, I will want to take him as a brother, hug him as a brother, go to his mother, go to his wife, go to his children, console them. And so therefore, if I'm in a boardroom of Northern Europe, or if I'm in something to do with the political organization of the world, and if I am transformed by the power of Christ, then I will try and avoid that situation from occurring. That person has to leave that. And I will then begin to question myself about Africa, about the richness that's there in Africa. And I will be asked myself about the justice and the peace that there's in our world. And that's what the Pope mentions as well. He says that, you know, as a people of God, we must always search for peace and justice in our world. And that's what mission is all about.
And my thanks there go to Divine Word missionary Father Timothy Lahan, the new Secretary General of the Pontifical Society for the Propagation of the Faith, and of course to Emma McCarthy. Another event worthy of note which takes place on the 18th of October is the European Day Against Human Trafficking. You may or may not know that there exists a group of women who have waged war against human trafficking. They're the International Union of Superiors General, who recently sponsored a conference focusing on human trafficking. They told me that, sadly, the trafficking has suffered the effect of the global financial crisis, with consequent soaring of poverty levels. The sisters who belong to this network try and find new ways to strengthen international cooperation among the hundreds of women's religious orders across the world. Among those on the front line in the fight against this trafficking is the representative for Africa, Nigerian-born Sister Patricia of the Order of Our Lady of St. Louis. Sister Patricia, you're based in Nigeria,
yes,
but you're responsible for the entire continent of Africa. Is that correct?
Yes, somehow.
Can you tell me a little bit how you got involved in the fight against human trafficking?
Actually, I got involved in this area of trafficking about over 10 years ago when I was president of Women Religious Nigeria. And you know that many Nigerian women are trafficked. So, you know, there's a conference, we became alarmed and we decided to set up a committee to look into it, which we call the Committee for the Support of the Dignity of Women, ISKOSUDO. It's 10 years in existence this year and its main work is to fight against human trafficking. So that was how I got involved. So I represented ISKOSUDO in various conferences and we came here to Italy and saw our women on the streets of Italy and how they were battered and debased and all that. And we felt we had to do something. So I think as a result of ISKOSUDO, being member of ISKOSUDO, in January 2007, CMC in the Netherlands, in collaboration with SRTV, organized a conference in Nairobi, Kenya, bringing all the Africans together, as many as could come. So that was where this African Network Against Human Trafficking was born. And in that, you know, well, about four of us represented Nigeria there. So it was as a result of our involvement there that then when we came, you know, I was then asked to represent, you know, to coordinate ANAT, so that the work of the other African countries, because unfortunately, Africa, you know, most of the women is a country of origin for a lot of this trafficking. Many of the victims, you know, we come, you know, we see them, we touch them, we feel them, and we felt that something has happened.
You mentioned trafficking here in Italy, trafficking for prostitution in this case.
For prostitution, sexual exploitation.
Exploitation mostly.
Yes, yes.
Do you have other kinds of trafficking from Africa or?
Yeah, there is mainly trafficking for organs, there is drug trafficking, there's so many traffic, but the one we are really concentrating on is this trafficking for sexual exploitation that involves women and girls.
What are the root causes of this trafficking?
Well, a lot of it, they say poverty, and I think to a great extent it is poverty, because we find that most of them, the victims, come from the third world countries or developing countries. But when we look in Nigeria, we also find that, a lot of it is also greed on the part of some of these and laziness. You know, I know things are hard, the situation is difficult, but if they had that sense of dignity, you know, some of them, instead of allowing themselves to be trafficked or giving, could go and start working, but the root cause is actually poverty.
You feel you're achieving something?
Yes, we are achieving a lot, even though the fact that we are achieving doesn't mean that it has reduced, but a lot of awareness has been created. Because even in Nigeria, you find that the government has a powerful arm, NAPTIP, that we collaborate with. So a lot of awareness has been created. So many people have been rescued. And here, I think I must thank the Italian Bishops' Conference, because they built a big shelter for us in Benin City in Nigeria, where many of these girls that are rescued are helped, you know. But still, there are so many cases. Some are still coming out or being trafficked because of this poverty that I mentioned.
These girls who come back to Africa after they've been trafficked, do they come back with diseases like HIV/AIDS or?
Some come back with, actually most of those with diseases, a good number of them die here with HIV, you know, like those that have come to us, we haven't had many cases, we've had one or two cases, you know, but those that are rescued, then we try to rehabilitate them and get them jobs, but many of them are dying here from HIV.
You're listening there to Patricia, a Nigerian sister of the Order of Saint Louis. She's made it her mission in life to fight against the trafficking of women. Meanwhile, on a totally different note, time for part 14 of the Vatican Centuries, in which we continue our journey back in time to rediscover some of the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican down the centuries. Well, last week we looked at how the connection between the papacy and the Frankish monarchy was forged, a connection which was to affect papal history decisively and give it the authority to play a significant role in the future history of Europe. We now reach the 8th century and the new empire. But to discover more, stay tuned for the next in this series, written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.
The 8th century had entered its last quarter. Of the five powers who controlled the world, two were in sharp decline, Byzantium and the Lombards.
A third, the papacy, was still fragile in actual power, though growing rapidly in authority and prestige. The forces of Islam had been temporarily halted, but the fear of a Saracen invasion was ever present.
The fifth power, which reached its zenith at this time, was personified by a man whom a contemporary poet indicated as the lighthouse of Europe. In our own time, he has been described as the greatest instrument for government and conquest since Julius Caesar.
We know him as Charlemagne.
At the turn of the century, the alliance between the papacy and the Frankish monarchy was sealed by the spectacular coronation of Charlemagne by the Pope after Christmas Mass in the Basilica of St. Peter's. It was the inevitable climax to the sequence of events which had begun half a century earlier on a cold January morning over 1,000 miles north of Rome.
On that occasion, Pope Stephen II, on bended knee, appealed to King Pippin for protection. Neither of the two protagonists realized at the time the significance of their historic meeting. For on that day, the pontifical state was born. The temporal power of the papacy came into being. It was to last well over 1,000 years.
On that epiphany morning in 754, a 12-year-old boy watched the scene, fascinated. He was Charles, Pippin's elder son, soon to pass from the role of spectator to that of leading man.
Charles the Great, or Charlemagne, lived from about 742 to 814 and is generally recognized as the greatest monarch of the Middle Ages. The kingdom of the Franks, which he inherited, stretched from the Pyrenees to the Rhine, from the Mediterranean to the North Sea. Charles, who was a brilliant soldier and an able politician, nearly doubled this kingdom, uniting in one super-state practically the whole of Western Europe. He encouraged learning, championed Christianity, and founded what later came to be known as the Holy Roman Empire.
The achievement of Charlemagne in making it a spiritual as well as an institutional unit gained him the title of King Father of Europe. At the end of World War II, when men were talking of a united Christian Western Europe, Charlemagne's model was invoked, and a Charles the Great Prize was instituted to be awarded for outstanding service to the cause of European unity.
Charles was a tireless worker, rising early and only interrupting his intense political activity to hunt or swim. At table he sat with his wife and children and enjoyed listening to music and a reading from his favourite book, St. Augustine's City of God.
Charles himself was not a cultured man. He barely knew how to write his name. But he was an enlightened ruler and saw the prime necessity of education. His chief advisor in this was Alcuin, the Anglo-Saxon monk and scholar whom he invited to direct his palace school and whom he grew to love as a father. Charles, we are told, sat at Alcuin's feet, learned Latin from him, spoke and prayed in it, read Greek but couldn't pronounce it, slept with tablets and pencils under his pillow, yet never quite mastered the art of writing.
It is said that Charlemagne never uttered an angry word, but he had no time for the lazy or for the willfully ignorant. Once, when he was inspecting a school, he noticed that the sons of poor men studied with greater profit than those of the rich or the nobility. He praised the former and reproved the latter, ending his speech with these words:
"Let none of you, not even if he is the son of a count, expect jobs or honours from me when he is taller, because I shall give nothing to anyone who has not deserved it."
Charles also had ideas about the duties of those who were dedicated to the service of God.
"It seems to us," he wrote on one occasion, "of sovereign usefulness that bishoprics and monasteries,
the government of which Christ has desired to entrust to me, should not content themselves with leading a regular, pious life, but that they should also fulfil the function of teaching. Without a doubt, it is preferable to act well than to know a lot, but it is necessary to know in order to do well.
Charles had a very strong sense of the sacred nature of his mission, which he declared to Leo III was to strengthen the Church in the knowledge of the Catholic faith. He was sincerely religious, and on the four different occasions when he visited Rome, he made pilgrimages to all the important churches and took part in the principal ceremonies of Easter and Christmas.
Like his father, Pippin, Charles undertook to protect Rome and the Pope against their enemies, and he kept his commitment faithfully. He made the interdependence of church and state a reality after the divisions and hostility which had existed under Byzantine rule.
A lifelong friend of Pope Hadrian I, Charles was grief-stricken at his death in 795. He had an epigraph specially composed by Alcuin and engraved on a tablet of black marble. The Latin inscription can still be seen, set high up in the wall, to the left of the main entrance of St. Peter's. Alcuin interpreted Charles's sorrow in these words.
I, Charles, wrote these verses in tears for your death, O Hadrian. You were for me a great, a sweet bond of affection, a revered father. And now I wish that here our names may be joined together forever. Hadrian and Charles, I king and you father.
Hadrian's successor, Leo III, sent Charles the keys of St. Peter's tomb and confirmed him as protector and defender of Rome. 5 years later, on Christmas night in the year 800, Charlemagne knelt in St. Peter's Basilica. The Pope placed a crown on the head of the Frankish king, while the crowd in St. Peter's acclaimed him as Emperor of the West. The new empire was born.
When Leo informed Charles of his election to the papacy, he requested the king to send a representative to receive the oath of loyalty from the Roman people. Charles sent the lay abbot Angilbert, laden with gifts, and with the mission of consolidating the relationship between himself and the church and the city of Rome. His letter has been preserved.
We have charged Angilbert to carry out all we deemed desirable for us and necessary for you, so that both of you by mutual agreement may establish whatever you consider necessary for the exaltation of the Holy Church of God, or for your honor, or for the consolidation of our protectorate. With the help of divine charity, it will be our task to defend the Holy Church of Christ from without, taking up arms against pagans and infidels, and to protect it within by the preservation of the Catholic faith. Your task, Holy Father, will be to act as guardian to our cavalry by raising your hands to heaven, like Moses, so that through your intercession and with his leadership, Christianity may, everywhere and always, achieve victory over the enemies of its holy name, and so that the name of our Lord may be glorified throughout the whole world.
You were listening there to part 14 of The Vatican Centuries, a series written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.